We have a pretty special Live Music Friday planned for Current State listeners here this Friday. And mind you, this will be happening in our 6 p.m. hour this Friday as Current State broadcasts live from the Great Lakes Folk Festival in downtown East Lansing. Dennis Stromat and L'Esprit Créole will be performing a lot of music here live for us before their formal performance later in the evening at the Great Lakes Folk Festival. But he is an interesting guy with all kinds of fascinating roots in Louisiana and French Creole country further north. You don't have to go all the way to Louisiana before you notice the influence of Creole music and French Creole influences. So Dennis Stromat and L'Esprit Créole, Friday, live, 6 p.m. Again, we'll be live 6 p.m., and we hope you can stop by and see us at the Great Lakes Folk Festival in downtown East Lansing. I'm Mark Bayshore. Monday has returned again. We're glad you're with us. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. School choice is a hot topic in Michigan these days. From debates over charter school accountability to vouchers for private schools, the issue can be a divisive one. But charters and vouchers aren't the only ways students are switching schools. Just as widespread is students choosing to go to public schools outside of their neighborhood district, a practice known as school of choice. Josh Cowan is an MSU professor who recently authored a report looking at which Michigan students were most likely to choose to go to a public school outside of their hometowns. I talked with Josh about his research last week and started out by asking him how many Michigan districts are participating in school of choice programs.
Most districts are, yes. They're encouraged to do so through sort of best practices at the state. But districts get to set their own rules. They get to participate to the extent that they want to. And there is a lot of variation across the state in that participation.
But are the ways that districts administer the programs diverse as
Very
well?
Very diverse, yes.
Okay. Can you go a little deeper on that?
So the most relevant thing is setting enrollment numbers and sort of what one does with students once they come into the district. Which schools they're going into, whether they're spread out throughout the district, that sort of thing.
How many Michigan students are attending schools outside their hometowns
at
or
present,
home districts?
At present, it's about 100,000, which is a comparable number, a little bit less, but comparable to the number of kids in charter schools here.
How much research has there been on school of choice policies?
That type of program, not a whole lot in Michigan, and actually not a whole lot elsewhere either. For me, it's a relative question. So we know a lot more about charter schools, for example, and even school vouchers, which aren't as common. But open enrollment policies, of which schools of choice is one, so inter-district open enrollment, most states have something like this. Either they require it or they strongly encourage it. And we really don't know as much about these types of programs as charters.
This kind of thing is not unique to Michigan. How many other states have similar school of choice programs?
Just about half require it and another half permit it in some way. Very small number don't have any sort of open enrollment program at all.
Charter schools and vouchers are in the news on a fairly regular basis. Why do you think school of choice hasn't gotten as much attention?
It's maybe a number of reasons. That's maybe as much a political question as anything else. Part of it's because, you know, we are talking about public schools. And so, you know, these are kids transferring within them. And some of the controversies surrounding these types of programs are fairly arcane controversies, things like budgeting and enrollment counts and things like that. Whereas when you're talking about charter schools, you're talking sometimes about which teachers are unionized or not, or how teachers are paid or not, or whether public schools are being abandoned or not. And those are sort of, I think, generally lend themselves to a little bit more debate. And usually what happens in public policy, where the debate is where the research is.
Joshua Cowan is an associate professor at the MSU College of Education. We're talking about his recent research into which students are utilizing Michigan's School of Choice program. So let's go there,
sure.
Josh. What were your main goals for this study?
So this is the first of a three-part study. The first part is just simply asking sort of who these students are, what rates they're participating in. And that sounds like a fairly basic question, but it's actually fairly tricky to answer. The second step is what's the impact of transferring under schools of choice on student outcomes, and we'll be getting to that this fall. And then the third is sort of a really careful look at some of the destination districts. So for this study, we found a number of pretty important patterns. Statewide, participants tend to be disproportionately African American. They tend to be disproportionately free reduced lunch kids, so lower income. And they tend to have lower test scores, especially in math, on the state test, relative to their peers in their resident districts before they transfer out under schools of choice.
Do we know anything about why those students were leaving their home districts?
No, that's a good question. And when you do this type of a bird's eye view, it's a tough one to get at. I mean, we can certainly speculate, you know, given some of these things. I mean, if you look at the test score numbers, for example, you might say, well, maybe they're leaving the resident district because they're not being as well academically served as their peers there. And that's very possible, but it's also possible that they're just more mobile, and mobility we know is correlated to perhaps lower achievement. So it's a tough question, and one of the reasons that we have parental choice, not just in Michigan, but all over the country, is this sort of, one of the arguments for it anyway, is sort of this philosophical argument that parents choose schools on a number of different dimensions. Some may be very common across lots of different parents, and some may be very specific to individual circumstances. And the theory is the more choice you give, you know, the happier parents are, even if they aren't sorting on things we can observe.
I take it part of what you found out, though, was that a high percentage of the students who leave their home district are highly inclined to return shortly thereafter.
Yeah, so even among the schools of choice participants that we see, we do find that the same characteristics that predict that a kid exits their resident district also predict that they exit school of choice. In lay terms, what that means is that there may be something of a bit of a revolving door, in and out of these different districts. We were able to look at three groups of kids who started in kindergarten. We followed all the way through fifth grade. And of those, among those three cohorts, only 40% stayed in schools of choice all the way from kindergarten through fifth grade. For African Americans, that's only about 29%, so less than a third. And so, you know, this is a fairly mobile group of kids overall. I should stress, though, that, you know, some of these are all statewide numbers, and that's important to have, but these may not gel with sort of individual district experiences, in part because districts are very demographically different, and in part because of some of these rules that I mentioned that might affect exit and entry rates in a given year. But these are the statewide patterns that we see.
It's interesting because just a couple of days ago, we had the president of the Lansing Board of Education, Peter Spadafore, on the program. And this is getting a little bit off the subject, but Peter pointed out that in some years, the Lansing School District has had a move ratio of as high as 19%. Yeah, so from the beginning of one school year to the end, 19, they haven't necessarily left the district, but they're in a different location.
Yes, and so that's an interesting point. And we see even higher numbers like in bigger and larger urban areas. So in Milwaukee, where I've done a lot of work on school choice, charter schools and so on, the within district transfer rate is above 30% there. So that's not even kids leaving the city, as you're describing. And what we're seeing here in Michigan, in schools of choice, those patterns I described to you really do resemble the type of mobility that you see in these environments, even within districts, between schools within districts. And again, it just tends to be kids that historically have been disadvantaged that are doing a lot of the moving around, which is not exactly what you necessarily find when you look at sort of mobility into charter schools, for example. So it's very important to distinguish between those two types of patterns.
Mm-hmm. And you have not yet determined the impact that this has on achievement. That's further down the
road. Correct. Okay. Correct. One thing we can say, not so much with the work we've done so far, but if you look at again, mobility elsewhere, I think most observers would agree that, generally speaking, high rates of mobility do not promote higher educational outcomes. But the trick is finding the right balance, right? Because staying in a school that's not serving your child is also not necessarily promoting an academic outcome. And so you want to, I mean, I think from a policy standpoint, and I'm trying not to be too prescriptive with this study, you want to be able to, again, strike that balance between giving a little bit of flexibility to move as the situation permits, but also encouraging a long-term stable relationship with the school that you've chosen.
We're talking about a recent MSU study that looked at which students in Michigan are most likely to use school of choice programs to attend schools outside of their home district. Our guest is Joshua Cowan, an associate professor at the MSU College of Education and lead author of the study. Anything particularly surprising in this first segment?
it's surprising giving sort of what I've heard on the ground coming in before we started the study. There does seem to be a lot of deliberate decision-making on parents' parts to send their kids to school of choice. You can't wake up in the morning and switch districts. You do have to put a little bit of effort in. And that would suggest that you're looking for a longer-term, more stable relationship than what our data seem to suggest is actually the case overall. And that's, I think, the most surprising thing we've seen.
Your research focuses on the students in school of choice yep. programs, but do we know anything about how moving students back and forth from different districts impacts the schools themselves? I mean, Michigan schools yeah. get funding based yeah. on the number of students they have, so I'm guessing this is something that has some impact on revenue.
Yeah, so the cost side of this is not something that we've looked at yet, and that's a very important one, and probably my sense is probably the real source of debate about the program here in Michigan. The budget uncertainty probably is the difficult angle here. There are some districts that certainly are net losers from a revenue standpoint, but you do see a lot of fluctuating and some districts getting a certain number of kids in a certain year and other districts not. And that does create implications for just how you budget things like teachers, for example. How many teachers do we need for the children that we're serving this year? And you know, if you have fewer kids next year, then you have maybe too many teachers and vice versa.
How do you explain to someone, a layperson who questions why this is important? Yeah. How do you respond?
Well, it's a program that's, you know, 100,000 Michigan kids are learning in districts outside the places they live. I mean, that's a massive program from a policy standpoint. So anything that large, I think, is worth looking into. And then sort of finally, you know, for the last 20 years, we've, as a country, but also in Michigan, Michigan's been one of the leaders on this, we've really pushed toward more forms of parental choice, right? We've had many more charter schools. Every sector of choice is expanding, not just in Michigan, but elsewhere. More states have voucher programs, and all but 8 states have charter schools. The number of charter schools nationwide is up 7% in just the last year, 6,000 charter schools across the country. This is all part of the same system of choice. The more we learn about it, we understand how parents are choosing and what the implications are and who's choosing, I think the better we can kind of inform these types of decision-making that is required to kind of both expand and maybe monitor some of these programs as they continue to develop.
So remind us what's next here, the next steps for this research project.
So the next immediate step is we're gonna look at the impact on academic outcomes for the kids who are transferring. So we're gonna look at a kid before they switch and see what happens to them after they go and how their test scores look. That's gonna be the big outcome. And then eventually we're gonna look and try to be very clear about which schools seem to be the high recipients of school mm-hmm. of choice kids.
Joshua Cowan is an associate professor in the MSU College of Education. We've been talking about his recent research into school of choice programs here in Michigan. Joshua, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it. Yeah, thanks.
And you're listening to Current State on 90.5. WKAR. Informed stargazers know that August is the month of the Perseid meteor shower. That's when the Earth passes through the dust from the tail of the comet Swift-Tuttle. Debris trailing the comet become visible as blazing streaks of light as they enter our planet's atmosphere. According to the website earthsky.org, this can result in as many as 50 sightings per hour, a sometimes captivating display. Meteor showers are of particular interest at a remote spot near the tip of Michigan's Lower Peninsula. That's where you'll find the Headlands International Dark Sky Park, just west of the Mackinac Bridge. To learn more about Headlands and the Perseids and more, we welcome back to the show Mary Stewart Adams, a veteran stargazer and sky watcher who is program director at Headlands up in Emmett County. Welcome back, Mary.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Let's clarify first where Headlands is exactly. How far west of the bridge are you?
It's exactly 2 miles west of the bridge.
Okay.
Yeah.
So head for the head for the bridge and turn left.
Yeah, right. If you've gone over the bridge, you've gone too far. So.
I certainly want to discuss the upcoming Perseids, which can be quite the sight every August. First, though, tell our listeners more about your dark sky park, your international dark sky park, no less. What exactly is a dark sky park?
Well, a dark sky park is an area of land that is protected because of its natural darkness and where we're mitigating light pollution. And the designation comes from the International Dark Sky Association, which is located in Tucson, Arizona. This is the oldest organization in the world that has set itself up specifically to protect and steward natural darkness in those areas of, throughout the world where it still remains. So they have a very rigorous criteria that they set up that you have to meet in order to receive their designation, which we achieved in 2011.
So you've had this designation for a few years. Are you attracting a lot of people to the place?
We are attracting thousands of people, and they come from all over the world. Mm. It's very exciting that way.
You get a lot of families with kids there?
We do. We get folks of all ages. We get school children. We get families with children. We get amateur and professional astronomers, astrophotographers. We have tour groups coming in with exchange students. Really everybody under the sky.
It's a
people
chance
who are interested in seeing the phenomena and being in natural darkness.
And it's a chance for kids to stay up past their bedtime, right?
Yeah, it is.
That can't hurt. What do people say they like most about the park and about the experience?
You know, Headlands is unique among dark sky parks because it's situated along the shores of the fifth largest body of fresh water in the world. So I think the most remarkable thing is just the beauty of the environment. So to be where there's this vast body of water, untouched shoreline, beautiful forest, and then natural darkness with the brilliant stars overhead.
Mary Stewart Adams is a veteran stargazer and sky watcher who is program director at Headlands up at in Emmett County. We're talking about the upcoming Perseid meteor shower and the International Dark Sky Park up there in Emmett County. Even casual stargazers know that August is the month of the Perseid meteor shower. When are we most likely to see a good display?
Well, you know, the average estimate is that the shower is strongest between August 11th and August 13th. But typically the peak occurs just after midnight between August 12th and 13th. What you need to know is that the meteor shower is named for the constellation in front of which the meteors seem to, that's the direction from which they seem to radiate.
Right.
So when that constellation is highest overhead, then you have the strongest showing of stars falling through the sky. And that's about 2 a.m. in Michigan.
And that means the Earth in its journey around, I mean, comets go around the sun as well.
I
want to walk through this here so I make sure I understand this, and hopefully this will help our listeners as well. The Earth is making a journey around the sun.
Yes.
Swift Tuttle is making a journey around the sun.
Yes.
And in August, this is when we pass through the trail of dust left behind by Swift Tuttle, hence the meteor shower.
Right. And the thing about that is, even though we can conceive of that, okay, Earth is moving through space, it's moving through...
You can conceive of it. I'm not sure I can conceive of it.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, this is what makes it so fascinating, because of the folks that have been involved through the centuries in figuring this out, that Earth is in motion, that it's rotating on its axis, that it's orbiting the sun, that it's wobbling, and that occasionally it passes through these fields of things that are left in its path. And that doesn't mean that you only look toward the direction of the constellation Perseus to see the meteor shower, because they'll seem to fall all over the sky. So you just need to lay down and look up and then try to conceive of this, that the fact that we are moving.
Mm-hmm.
It's mind-boggling.
And what exactly are we seeing when we see the streak of light that is a meteor? What is that?
Well, it's sometimes a particle that's no larger than a grain of sand. And it strikes our atmosphere, and because it's the speed at which it's moving, that causes it to burn up. So we see the trail of stuff that's left by that burning up. And sometimes the color can be quite remarkable, and that is determined by the elements that make up that substance. So, for instance, if there's nickel, then you'll see this really kind of blue-green flash, which can be magnificent. The thing that's most exciting about the Perseids is that they seem to leave really long trails, so you can see it for quite a while. It's kind of not just a
exactly.
quick.
Exactly, yeah. And where are they? I mean, are they a mile off the ground? Are they 10 miles off the ground? Do you know?
You know, that's a question that I can't really answer, although I know that they're not all just one uniform distance from us, because there's something called a fireball that will be almost, it's large, and it seems to burn up quite close because you can hear it. So it's not beyond our, you know, the sound barrier. It's something that you can hear moving right through your atmosphere, mm-hmm. and that's a magnificent experience.
Well, it wasn't that long ago that there was a colossal fireball where Russia, I want to
yes.
say, the Arctic Circle,
yeah, yeah.
the winter before last, maybe,
yes,
and it lit
and
up the whole
is,
sky.
Yeah.
Siberia,
that's,
yeah.
That's the region where we have the most, at least the most recorded occurrence of that kind of thing. But I have seen in northern Michigan, I have seen fireballs connected with the Perseid a few times. It's really exciting.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
We are talking with Mary Stewart Adams. Mary is the program director at Headlands International Dark Sky Park up in Emmett County, just a couple of miles west of the Mackinac Bridge. And we're talking about the park, and we're talking about the upcoming Perseid meteor shower. Remind us what a meteorite is. Mary, what is that?
Well, there's meteors, there's meteoroids, and meteorites, and the different definitions are based on whether it actually entered our atmosphere, burned up in our atmosphere, and if it comes all the way to the Earth. Most of them do not. So that's what the difference is between those definitions. And the thing about the Perseids also that makes it exciting for stargazers is that it really marks the beginning of the most active meteor shower season, because now we have a meteor shower almost every month until we get to December.
No kidding. But the Perseids
yeah.
is easily the most renowned, correct?
The most renowned, although it's been kind of trumped in activity lately by the Geminids, which happen at the same time of month in December, around the 13th of December.
Oh, how exciting.
Yeah.
Well, you have events planned for this then?
We do. What we do, because we're an international dark sky park, a lot of what motivates our activity is to raise awareness about protecting natural darkness, because it is a vanishing resource. And we now are starting to really do research about what is the consequence of not being in natural darkness, not only in terms of human health and well-being, but for natural habitat, and then the amount of energy that we're using to turn on light that is spilling up into the sky where we don't need it. So the night of August 11th, which is the Tuesday of Perseid Week, we host a friendly competition in the local communities in Emmett County where we invite them to take a lights out challenge.
Hmm.
So we have the communities of Mackinac City and St. Ignace competing with one another, as well as the communities of Harbor Springs and Petoskey, where all the residents and businesses take a pledge to turn their lights off for an hour.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, then we have staff go around and we measure the sky quality first ahead of time on a typical night when there's typical light, and then during the time that the lights are turned
wow.
off, as many lights as we can get off, just to see who can get darker. It's a lot of fun.
You are into it. I like it.
Yeah, yeah.
On your website, which is, by the way, midarkskypark.org.
It's actually darkskypark.org. And it's funny.
I misread
because
that.
Yeah.
My dark, of course, midarkskypark.org. Okay,
yes.
well done.
Yes.
But it says that you speak to audiences about our relationship to the night sky and its cultural consequences here. What do you mean by cultural consequences?
You know, so this is, I'll try to say it as clearly as I can. When we think about something like the Perseid meteor shower, now we've been describing it as a time when the Earth is moving through the trail of stuff that's left by a comet that's coming through our system. But you have to first have the concept that the Earth is moving to give that way of describing a meteor shower. That idea is not that old. It's just about 400 or 500 years old. Prior to that time, the Perseid meteor shower was still happening. But because the concept that was prevalent among human beings that were thinking about this was that the Earth was fixed at the center, then the meteor shower wasn't caused by us moving through something. It was a gift coming from the celestial world.
Mm.
So, for instance, from the hero Perseus. So then it backs us into the story. Well, what is the story of Perseus in the different cultures that have a recording about this meteor shower? So that way of thinking about the night sky really informs the cultural sphere. It informs the art and the architecture, the literature, and even the scientific research and discovery. Over time, we see that changing, and the change is coincident with our understanding of the celestial phenomena. So that's the place where I really try to kind of pull off the covers and say, let's think about that, because it helps us to really pay attention to what our understanding is now and how that might motivate things that are happening in our day-to-day world,
mm.
how we think about these phenomena and how we define them to ourselves.
Well put. In all your years of stargazing and sky watching, have you ever seen anything in the night sky that genuinely puzzled you in a creepy kind of way?
Yes, once.
Oh, you got to tell us about it.
It was a standout moment. It was a February, and I was in Petoskey. There had been a winter blues parade, which is something that we do in northern Michigan when it's really cold and there are not a lot of resorters or tourists in town because it's too cold. So this was a nighttime parade that was organized by the Petoskey Chamber of Commerce. And as far as I was concerned, having a parade at night in the middle of February was all about the night sky. So I invited everyone along the parade path over to Stafford's Perry Hotel, where we had a beautiful view over the bay looking at the constellations. And we had some telescopes set up aimed at the region of the constellation Orion. And most people were lined up to look at that and listen to the astronomers that were manning the telescopes. And a woman walked up to me and asked me about a lecture I had given a few weeks earlier and a particular star in the constellation Cetus. And I pointed off in a direction where no one else was looking but this woman and her daughter and I. Her husband had just turned around for a moment to talk to someone else. And as I was pointing off in a space, something seemed to move toward us. And we both kind of stopped. This happened over a period of about 30 seconds. So not really long, but long enough for us to both say, well, what is that? And just as I said that, it just immediately disappeared, and a shooting star went right over the area where it was. And it just moved very quickly. It seemed to come in, bank up, stop, and then disappear. And we looked at each other and were exclaiming. Her husband turned around and said, what are you talking about? We said, didn't you see that? And there was no way to describe what it was. So we made a secret handshake and decided that that would be the way that we would just acknowledge to one another that we had for a moment experienced something we couldn't describe. Because I don't know of a man-made machine. Now we have drones, and maybe it was something like that, but we heard no sound. There wasn't any light. It really stopped in its motion.
We have to leave it there. That's a captivating way to end our discussion. We want to thank Mary Stewart Adams, veteran stargazer and sky watcher. We're talking about the upcoming Perseid meteor shower and her work at Headlands International Dark Sky Park up in Emmett County. Thanks, Mary.
Thanks for having me again.
And coming up on Current State, 15,000 members of an elite Boy Scouting organization called the Order of the Arrow will be on the MSU campus this week. Current State Scott Pohl talks with Order of the Arrow team leader Clyde Mayer about their emphasis on serving others. Plus, last week we told you the tale of the Great Lakes ship, the SS Henry B. Smith. She was launched in the great storm of November 1913 on Lake Superior. Current State's Peter Wharf has the second part of his conversation with author Frederick Stonehouse, author of The Last Laker. That and more after the break. Welcome back to Current State. 15,000 members of an elite Boy Scout organization have arrived for a week-long conference at Michigan State University, and we sent Scott Pohl out to learn more about the Order of the Arrow. What can you tell us, Scott?
Well, Mark, if you're on the MSU campus or in East Lansing this week, you're sure to see Boy Scout uniforms everywhere. The Order of the Arrow is here for training, for fun, and for some public service. Here's an example. On Friday morning, MSU will conduct a massive evacuation drill on campus, and thousands of these scouts will be walking from residence halls to Spartan Stadium, creating a lot of foot traffic for everybody involved in the exercise. I spent some time with Order of the Arrow team leader Clyde Mayer. The group emphasizes outdoors activities, especially camping, so we decided to talk along the banks of the Red Cedar River.
The Order of the Arrow is Scouting's National Honor Society, and this year we're celebrating our 100th anniversary in the Order of the Arrow. It started back in 1915, and so this is a very special occasion for us here.
What was the idea at its founding?
Well, Erna Goodman founded the Order of the Arrow on the basis of encouraging young people to camp. It started in a summer camp. And from that point on, we have been encouraging our young people that are in the Boy Scouting program to go outdoors and enjoy the outdoor environment.
You know, I think people think of Boy Scouting as being largely outdoors and that camping is a big part of scouting in general. Is it just more so with the Order of the Arrow?
Well, first of all, let me say that young people that become part of our program in the Order of the Arrow is a part of the Boy Scout program, are boys that have demonstrated a certain skill level and experience level in the scouting program. Only boys that are actually first-class scouts can be elected into our program, so they have some background and some experience in the scouting program before they ever get selected into the program. So the intent for those boys is to go on and encourage other young people to enjoy the outdoors, to stay in scouting and the scouting program.
How does a boy become nominated for membership in the Order of the Arrow?
Well, actually, he gets elected by the members in his troop.
The other boys?
Yes, the other boys, his peers, both non-members and members.
How frequently does that happen, or what percentage of your typical scouting troop might be members of the Order of the Arrow?
Well, any boy that, of course, meets the requirements, one of those being a first-class scout, a boy has to have had so many days and nights of camping, have attended a summer camp program, and so forth. If he meets those requirements and 50% of the boys in his troop elect him to go into the Order of the Arrow, we can take as many as they elect into the program.
Are there any special responsibilities or duties? What's expected of a boy who becomes a member of the Order of the Arrow?
Good question, Scott. The primary responsibility of a boy that comes into the Order of the Arrow is to go back and serve his troop or team, and to encourage young people again to stay in the scouting program, to get outdoors, to do the camping that we're talking about. So, you know, that's his primary responsibility.
Are there special camping skills you have to be able to demonstrate? And if so, what are they?
No, those are usually locked in with the scouting requirements, as you probably know, that a boy, as he goes up the ranks from tenderfoot to second class to first class and so forth, learns. So we're not asking that they have any other special skills as far as outdoor requirements go, but we have an expectation that by the time a boy becomes a first class scout, he has a lot of those. And really, this program is all about serving your unit, encouraging young people to stay in the program, and hopefully, you know, make Eagle Scout sometime.
I was just going to ask you what relationship there might be to being in the Order of the Arrow and ultimately at some point perhaps becoming an Eagle Scout.
Yeah, well, you know, here at the National Order of the Arrow Conference, we have an organization in the Boy Scouting program called the National Eagle Scout Association. And basically, I like to refer to both pieces of our organization as basically serving the same group, because a lot of the boys that are in the Order of the Arrow are also Eagle Scouts. I would say probably 80% of the boys that are going to be here next week or this week are going to be will be Eagle Scouts as well as Arrowmen.
We're talking with Clyde Mayer. He is a team leader with the Order of the Arrow. 15,000 members of this select Boy Scouting organization are meeting this week on the MSU campus. Were you a member of the Order of the Arrow yourself as a boy?
Not as a boy. I actually came into the Order of the Arrow when I first got involved with professional scouting. I've been a professional scouter for 41 years, so I've been in the Order of the Arrow, of course, all during that period of time. But as a young person, I didn't have that opportunity to get into the Order of the Arrow. You know, we have 15,000 members here, but what your audience might be interested in knowing is, as part of the Boy Scouting program, we serve about 170,000 of our Boy Scout members that are members of the Order of the Arrow. Now, some of those are adults as well as young people, about a 60-40% split there. But we serve a group, a pretty sizable group of Boy Scouts.
All right, well, 15,000 of you are on this campus, and so I want to ask you about what they're here for. What will members of the Order of the Arrow be doing while they're on the MSU campus?
We do a National Order of the Arrow Conference every, right now we're doing them every 3 years, but we're probably going to get back into a rotation where we're doing them every 2 years. But the reason why we bring our airmen together is basically for training. This is a training opportunity for airmen across the country. We will literally have members from all 50 states coming to this conference and being a part of this. But the main thrust and the main focus is training, helping them and teaching them skills and providing them experiences that they can take back to their lodges, their councils, to help their programs be better. That's really what the focus of this is. Now, we have a lot of other things going on. You know, when you bring young people together for 6 days, it can't just be training. We understand that there needs to be some activities, some fun, some special events and things that we also do at a national or their conference. But if you want to nail it down to exactly what this is about, it's about training and helping young people and adults go back home and serve their units and help them be more successful.
I understand there are three honor levels within the organization. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, let me just correct that a little bit. We do have one honor level. Really, they're membership levels. The first level is just being an ordeal member. That's when the boy first comes into the program. About a year after that, he is eligible to take his brotherhood membership, which is full membership in the Order of the Arrow. And then we have a third level, which is really an honor. It's called the Vigil Honor level. And this is really where a young person is given that level of membership or honor after he has demonstrated certain skills. He has spent some time in the program. He has shown himself to be someone that has stood out and beyond other folks, and he is recognized with the Vigil Honor, which is the highest recognition that we provide either a youth or an adult at the council level of our program.
Is there anything within that would be akin to a test, or in some fashion needing to spend time alone in the woods, maybe anything like that to prove that you're worthy?
All the way through our programs, even starting at the ordeal level and so forth, we have some, if you want to call them, tests or requirements that a young person spend a day in service helping his fellow man. We ask them to sleep out at night, nothing any different than what we would do at a normal camping, with a normal camping type of experience and so forth. You know, doing a little fasting, that kind of stuff, but all under very tight controls, you know, to send a message to the young person about what this program is all about. It's about service and sacrifice. Later on, if he becomes a Vigil Honor member, we ask a person to spend a night alone, you know, nothing unusual about that, but an opportunity to reflect on what he's done in scouting and what he might do later on in the program. So, yeah, there's some of those kinds of experiences, but all very well controlled.
Clyde Mayer is a team leader with the Order of the Arrow. The scouting organization has 15,000 members on the MSU campus this week. You know, we can't talk about scouting in this day and age without talking about the recent decision at the national level to allow gays to hold leadership roles. Has this been discussed within the Order of the Arrow leadership?
Let me first of all say that the Order of the Arrow is a part of the Boy Scouts of America, and when our executive board here, I'm sure you're referring back to Monday's decision about allowing openly gay adults to serve in leadership positions in our scouting program. Obviously, our program follows right along with the decisions of our executive board and, accept that decision.
What do you see in the future of the Order of the Arrow?
What do I see in the future of the Order of the Arrow? I hope that our order will continue to be of service to our councils and scouting programs. We have done some major projects, national service projects, across the country. Basically, at the national level, we try to serve as role models of the kinds of things that might be able, our arrowmen and our leadership might be able to do back home in their local councils and lodges. But I would hope we could continue that trend, that we send this message to young people and adults that serving mankind and serving others is really important in this day and age, and continue to provide programs that set that kind of example.
15,000 members of the scouting organization called the Order of the Arrow are on the MSU campus through Saturday. We've been talking with Clyde Mayer. He's a team leader with the Order of the Arrow. Thanks for joining us here on Current State.
Hey, it was a pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Enjoy your time in East Lansing.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We come your way every weekday at noon on AM 870 as well. Last week on Current State, we brought you the saga of the Great Lakes ship, the SS Henry B. Smith. The life and loss of the Smith is a central story to a new book by Marquette-based author Frederick Stonehouse. The Last Laker, Finding a Wreck Lost in the Great Lakes' Deadliest Storm, recalled the 1913 hurricane-strength storm that ripped through the lakes, resulting in the greatest loss of life and ships from a single storm to date. For a century, the Henry B. Smith eluded divers and maritime experts. The Smith's life, death, and rediscovery are vividly recreated in The Last Laker. In this second installment of their two-part conversation, Current State's Peter Wharf and Frederick Stonehouse discuss the storm's outbreak. The Henry B. Smith captain, James Owen, was misled by the calm conditions on Lake Superior as he set sail that fateful November day.
Others got caught periodically in the same type of situation that was not unknown when a major storm came through. I would hesitate to call it a rookie mistake as much as an error in judgment legitimately made.
Right.
But again, a well-seasoned captain had an excellent, excellent record. So I don't think that was something that was I don't think that was a decision made lightly. I think it was a decision based on what his weather sense told him. And that's what many of the old-time captains really went by, is what they saw as weather signs. And in this case, it just proved to be a very fatal mistake.
There's a photograph that I thought was fascinating on page 71 of your book with the caption, "Lake Huron's Canadian shore was littered with lost sailors." I've never really seen a photo like this before, almost like the beach on an amphibious invasion, where you see a man standing over several drowned men on the shores of Lake Huron.
It did indeed, and many of them would end up on the kind of the south east shore of Lake Huron, where they were policed up and taken to local morgues as such as they could find them. In some cases, the furniture store doubled as one because they had nothing else in town. Certainly a very sad circumstance in many ways, obviously.
The Last Laker is the new book by Frederick Stonehouse. We're talking with him right now on Current State. You talk about those last moments of the Smith and what those might have been like. Can I read a little bit from page 115 for a second?
Please do.
This is some of the last moments that Frederick Stonehouse describes of the Smith in Lake Superior. And Captain Owen, a veteran and highly capable sailor, Captain Owen fought the storm with all of his substantial skill, but was losing the battle in the increasing maelstrom. His standing rigging was screaming from the rising wind. Soon it was howling, a chorus suitable for a priestly choir from the Spanish Inquisition, intended to drown out the terrible screams of their innocent and helpless victims. Once the hatch covers started to loosen, the fight was over. If the covers breached during darkness, Captain Owen likely never would have known, unable to see the black deck stretching behind him. Although his generator provided electric power for deck lights, nearly all were smashed already by the waves. The surging water searched out every weakness, flooding into the cargo holds with every passing wave. Although the engineers kept their big steam pumps clanging away at full capacity, they couldn't expel the water quickly enough as it poured through the smashed stern cabin doors and down deep into the engine room and bilges. Waves ripped doors off their hinges, skylights and porthole stove, and bulkheads knocked asunder. The lifeboats were long since swept off their davits and blown into the lake. Losing the lifeboats made no difference anyway. There wasn't a boat made that could survive the terrible uproar of wind or water or crew capable of launching one in the screaming storm anyway. The end for the Smith and her crew was coming soon. You talked a little bit about those cargo holds and the idea of canvas covers, and maybe that was a possibility for the flooding.
Yeah, and that's part of the, I don't want to say, part of the challenge of writing a book like this is trying to figure out what happened what could have happened. Obviously, we're not making definitive decisions. But this particular ship, as did several others that came out of the yards, had something called a telescoping hatch cover. And essentially what it is was a series of leaves that folded in on one another. So you had five from the right side, five from the left side. Then they had a chain drive that allowed them to slide open one on top of the other or shut them the same way in reverse. And they had a small lipping device then that held to the combing or that portion of the hatch where it comes through the hull, so they kind of locked in place. It was a good theory. It worked well in calm water when you really didn't have boarding seas or any significant wave damage potential. But if you took that out into the conditions that the Smith were in, the only way you could be certain that those hatches did not leak, because this was steel on steel and many little pieces of steel on steel, was to cover them with a heavy tarp or tarpaulin. And then in turn, you had strong backs or heavy pieces of wood or other steel then across the top of the hatch that would be fastened down to the hatch using what was known as C-clamps, much like you would see a clamp used in furniture making. And those together then would lock that hatch very tight, very secure, very watertight. Captain Owen did not put those additional tarpaulins on the hatch, because when he looked out of the harbor and saw the lull coming through, it was his belief that the storm was broken, the waves were falling off, and there was no reason to put the crew through the work of putting this added level of protection on. So as a result, when she got into the storm conditions, the waves were powerful enough to be able to peel back those hatch covers, and that steel was I think, 3/8-inch diameter, or 3/8-inch thickness, so that those begin to fold back, much like you would take the leaves of an avocado and pull them off as trying to reach the fruit within. And once you lost one section of a hatch, then it was Katie bar the door, because that then would become a torrent of water going into the cargo hold. The cargo hold was common. In other words, the entire length of the ship, there were no watertight divisions within the hold, so the water would migrate wherever it wanted to go once it got into the cargo. And then, of course, one hatch went, another hatch went, another hatch went. And in looking at the underwater videography of the wreck, it is very clear that virtually every hatch cover was gone. And the dynamic of how they lost them, both storm action as well as the ship diving to the bottom and then the air pressure within blowing them off, is certainly another hypothesis that would account for many. But that was the weakness in the Henry B. Smith, and also the weakness in several other Lake Superior shipwrecks that were lost. Again, arguably the same reason, that particular design of hatch. But let me make one thing clear. I didn't find this wreck.
Right, I know.
I want to be very clear that the team that did find it, Jerry Eliason and Ken Merriman and Craig Smith, three folks from Minnesota that have been very successful in finding these Great Lake shipwrecks. I think they've got a dozen or so under their belt. And I need to give all the accolades I can to their tremendous ethic and skill set in being able to do so.
We'll get back to more about the Smith in just a second. I wanted to ask you about another story that I thought had some really fascinating details, and those were the losses of the Regina and the Price.
Right. Regina and Price were two Canadian vessels, both of them lost in the storm. It really didn't come to light what had happened with these two ships until they began to look at the bodies along the Canadian shore. And what they found were Regina bodies wearing life jackets from the Price, and Price bodies wearing life jackets from the Regina.
Right.
And once they realized that, then you began to have stories and hypotheses that suggested that these two ships had collided somewhere in the lake, and the crew from one jumped to the other, and they didn't have their own life jackets, so they were given the life jackets, two from the other ship. The reality proved to be far more macabre. What had happened was the bodies had come ashore on the Canadian shore. The locals had come down to the bodies and had literally stripped them of valuables, and including any of the life jackets that were on the bodies. When the Canadian police realized what was happening, they had put out the threat that if everything didn't go back to where the locals found it, then there would be charges rendered against the folks that were doing the ghoulish behavior. So they went back to the beach, they put the jackets back on the bodies, and as a result, they often put them on the wrong body. So that then is what caused the whole theory of the collision between the two ships.
I really liked what Jerry Eliasson said about the Smith, which is, in a lot of ways, the central character of this book. Jerry said, "The Henry B. Smith has it all. History, mystery, and a beautiful wreck." What did you think about that?
I think Jerry's right on. I mean, this is a wreck that's sitting on the bottom, other than being cracked amidship, largely intact. And it is certainly what you would, if you were in Hollywood trying to put together what a shipwreck would look like, it would be the Henry B.
Frederick Stonehouse is the author of the new book, The Last Laker, Finding a Wreck Lost in the Great Lakes Deadliest Storm. Frederick, thanks a lot for the conversation and the great history.
Well, you're very gracious. Thank you for allowing me to speak about a subject which I'm passionate about and which I just find fascinating.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
And that's Current State for today. Coming up tomorrow on our program, for a year and a half, we've been tracking the process of making a movie in Michigan. Filmmaker Rich Gutierrez's Eastern Market is set in Detroit. Current State Scott Pohl has our latest update, including a look at how the elimination of state film incentives has affected the project. Plus, when you think of wildlife refuges, Detroit probably isn't the first place that pops to mind, but conservation scientists are paying increasing attention to the potential of urban spaces. John Hartig is one of those scientists. Current State's April Van Buren talks to him about the Detroit River International Wildlife Refuge, which he manages. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter as well, at KAR Current State. Have a great day. We'll see you Tuesday on WKAR's Current State.